22nd, 2007. Welcome, members. We have several Senate bills to start in on, so I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 479A. Mr. Olson, if you'd be so kind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 479A requires the use of self-extinguishing light bulbs in schools as of July 1st, 2008. Requires schools to replace non-self-extinguishing metal halide or mercury vapor light bulbs with T-type light bulbs or alternative lighting on or before July 1st, 2008. The bill exempts stadiums and outdoor athletic fields, declares an emergency, and is effective July 1st, 2007. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Senator Devlin, pleasure to have you here. Welcome to the House Education Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 479. Senate Bill 479 comes to you with a unanimous vote in the respective Senate committee and a 28-1 vote on the Senate floor. And when you hear the testimony today, I think you'll realize why it was such a unanimous vote.
Senator, I'll have to ask you to identify yourself for the record, please.
Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19.
Thank you, sir.
SB 479 requires school districts to replace type R metal halide bulbs with self-extinguishing type T bulbs. As amended, this bill makes it clear that school districts do not have to replace type R bulbs in stadiums or athletic fields. Also, school districts may choose to replace the halide bulbs with other types of lighting. Type R bulbs are extremely dangerous and come with the following warning. If you were to take them from a package, this is what you would read on the outside of the package. Warning, this light can cause serious skin burns and eye inflammation from shortwave ultraviolet radiation if outer envelope of the lamp is broken or punctured. Do not use where people will remain more than a few minutes unless adequate shielding or other safety precautions are used. Lamps that will automatically extinguish when the outer envelope is broken are commercially available. When these bulbs are broken and unshielded high-intensity metal halide or vapor lights continue to basically operate, they pose a significant health hazard and a threat of very serious eye and skin injuries, which you will hear about later in the testimony. Type R bulbs are commonly found in school gyms and covered play areas. In Oregon, discussion of the dangers of metal halide lights first was brought to the public's attention in 2004. It began with a very preventable accident that occurred in a gym at Bryant Elementary School in Lake Oswego, an elementary school not unlike many of yours. Teachers were attending an in-service training day. Unknowingly, many of them were sitting under a broken type R metal halide light. Because of the broken bulb, the teachers were exposed to the equivalent of 41 days of UV ultraviolet radiation in a five-hour period. Almost half the teachers reported symptoms of burning skin and eyes. Three teachers sitting directly below the bulb were severely injured. Some of these teachers are here today. One will testify. One is confined to her home following this incident. Following this incident also, the Department of Consumer and Business Services Occupational Safety and Health Division sent out 14,000 alerts to schools, warehouses, and businesses warning them of the hazard posed by ultraviolet light overexposures from broken metal halide bulbs. Some may call this incident isolated, but as this bill has gotten more attention both in the state and nationally, we have received numerous emails from other incidents like this. Let me just cite three. In 1999, West Virginia, a volleyball coach and players were temporarily blinded by a broken mercury vapor light, an early version of metal halide. In 2003, Tennessee wrestlers and fans complained of rashes, pain, and flu-like symptoms after exposures to a cracked halide light. In 2003, schools in Saskatchewan, Canada, were delayed after 26 teachers exposed to a broken light grew sick and complained of eye pain and blindness after sitting in a gym. The solution is clear. In fact, the solution is as simple as changing a light bulb. Type R bulbs are easily replaced with type T bulbs. The advantage of type T bulbs are that they are self-extinguishing within 15 minutes if the outer cover is broken. What happened to these teachers is an example of the unseen dangers of continuing to use type R light bulbs. Metal halide bulbs are dangerous and have no place in Oregon's public schools, particularly not in our gymnasiums or our multipurpose rooms. SB 479 protects students, teachers, and community members who use our school buildings. Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to support this legislation.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any questions, members from the Senator?
Yeah. Representative Wisdom. Thank you, Mr. Senator, for bringing this. I'm worried they don't understand we're declaring an emergency, but we're not going to require it to be done until July of 2008.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnant, I believe the bill is effective in July of 2008, and that was simply to give school districts enough time to examine what they have remaining in their fixtures and enough time to replace them. I have worked actually with the Oregon School Boards Association and COSA, and I believe they're both here to support the bill, and I actually offered them even a further six-month extension in a previous consideration of this, and they didn't think it was necessary.
Follow up. Senator, thank you. But we're going to exempt stadiums and outdoor athletic fields. There's no risk.
My understanding, and obviously not being a lighting professional, I actually consult my lighting professional, which happens to be the labor commissioner for the state of Oregon, electrician, is that stadiums commonly now use, I believe it's high-pressure sodium, which is actually less dangerous, actually more environmentally friendly, more energy efficient. There may be a few stadiums that still have metal halide bulbs. However, they are of a type and a size where there is no comparable type T bulb. There is no comparable self-extinguishing bulb at their wattage levels. So we exempted that simply because we believe that we wanted to keep the cost of this to a reasonable level, and we did not fully anticipate what the cost would be in stadiums. But we do not believe the incidence is particularly high any
Thank
longer.
And also with any effective radiation, the power of it is reduced by the cube of the distance.
Yeah.
So when they're up high, it's probably less.
Senator, I think the event that occurred at Lake Oswego happened some time ago, so I guess my comment is I'm not sure how many more. Where I'm going with this is I think we should be able to do it sooner than July the 1st, 2008, because we've been aware of this situation, and you've stated it doesn't take long to replace them. So my concern is, you know, we've declared an emergency, which I'm okay with, but then we're saying, but that emergency is not going to end until July the 1st, 2008. I'd like to see this done sooner, is my point. Yeah.
Thanks, Representative. Representative Roblin.
Thank you. Mostly just a comment. I think I mentioned to our other committee, we had a student that came to our school who has the sensitivity to light that she cannot be outside at all. The student could not be outside, and any UV light was a problem. And so we had the advantage of having little meters given to us to go and check every place she was going to be. And these lights give off UV light to the extent that they would hurt her. So every one of our light bulbs, they make shields. They are little deals for these that you can put over all of them, and we did that through our whole school. They make there's companies in state which will do the windows, so we can shield the windows so you can still see it. But, you know, to move from classroom to classroom was life-threatening. But we did have a chance. And our stadium, you couldn't at night. It was not a problem. It probably was the distance. But in our basketball, there were only certain places you would want to be in that gym if you were, even when they were shielded, protected, right? It's still giving off a fair amount. I mean, I don't think people realize. I certainly did not until 4 or 5 years ago. So we walked everywhere. We made sure that all the stuff is so that we could get passages for her and figure out ways to move in that building so that student could have the opportunity to go to a regular school. And she had been to a couple others before. She was in high school when she got to us. And she would dash to and from the car, put over whatever it took. It was an interesting thing to recognize, that there are people who are a whole lot more sensitive to this. And I think that most of us live in a life not understanding at all. And sometimes I think it affects us more than we know. So I appreciate the bill, and I think that it's a good thing we're doing.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dollum.
Yes, I would ask the good senator, in the research you did, it seems like we've known about this for a time. How many schools are we talking about that still have the R-type bulbs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dallum, in our discussions with a number of parties, it may be a limited number, but I hate to put it to you this way, Representative Dallum, being a Ways and Means Committee member, we asked for... in a potential bill for schools to be inventoried by the Department of Ed for how many minutes of PE they are conducting. The fiscal on that was about $180,000. So my understanding is that there are about 1,500 schools in the state, approximately 15. These would be primarily in gymnasiums. We believe that most people have recognized the problem, but we just want to make sure that this information gets out there, and we've got the full cooperation. We've got the full cooperation of the School Boards Association in COSIN. I've just been handed a note that the Dallas School District is currently replacing their bulbs.
That's where I wasn't particularly headed to the Dallas, but thank you. When we talk about the economic impact, there's two questions I would ask, and where I was going with this is, how many schools do we have involved? And I believe that the number is diminishing every day. So the point being that the economic impact, although it could be significant to an individual school, on a statewide basis wouldn't be much. And the second question that I would ask you is the life of an R-light. What is the normal life of a light? I think by implementation time our numbers will be even smaller.
Yes, I think it's in the neighborhood of, I'm just going by memory here, so don't quote me, about 15,000 hours.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlee. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that there's some liability issues with the schools. Is there? And it seems to me that ought to motivate them to move very quickly on this. There, risk management people ought to be talking to them about this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, my hope and my belief actually is that schools will do this because they think it's the best thing for the health of their employees and their students and members of the community. But I do believe that there's a degree of significant liability in continuing to use these bulbs, particularly given the notices that have went out, particularly given the cases that are commonly known. And I think many school districts have recognized that. You might be interested in knowing that some people, one of the senators that voted for this in committee, basically asked, well, haven't the teachers filed suit against the lighting company or the manufacturer of the lights? Well, it's under the ultimate repose. The original manufacturer was decades ago in terms of when the lights were developed. There are obviously more efficient, more safe means available now, but they actually have no recourse against the manufacturer under our laws.
See no further questions. Senator Devlin, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson, could you please let us know who our next witnesses will be? That sounds fine.
If we can please have Cheryl Rhodes, Joel LaFollette, and Mary Ann Guest.
Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you.
Ms. Ressa, are the lights all right where we are having? Might be
okay.
You be okay?
Keep my head down.
All right. We can dim them down further.
Oh, yes. I've got a couple. And then I have two people that I'm unable to reach today. Good afternoon.
My name is Joel LaFollette. I'm from Westland, Oregon. My wife, Kelly, was one of the teachers who was sitting at ground zero underneath the broken metal halide light. She's not able to be here. She has been confined to our home for the last 6 months by our doctor. She did work after the accident for 2 years, or approximately 2 years. When the doctor found that she was not healing, he decided that it was time to put her in an environment that was conducive to healing, which the work environment was not. She spent the last 6 months in the darkest portions of our home, much of the time wearing dark glasses, even in our home. I've become an expert in installing dimmer switches. Today, she's in Boston, Massachusetts, at our expense, having a scleral lens fitted to her eye. You have to imagine her eye is like a pitted windshield, and light hitting it refracts, hitting millions of nerve endings, just causing excruciating pain. Hopefully with this lens, they'll be able to use a liquid bandage against the surface of her eye and fill in those pits and allow her to live a semi-normal life when she's wearing those. No one knows at this point when she'll heal, but we do hope that sometime we will see permanent healing. The doctor basically tells us that her exposure to the ultraviolet radiation that Senator Devlin referred to changed the DNA makeup of her cornea. And so the epithelial layer, the outside layer of her eye, does not rebuild in a state that can maintain itself. And so it continues to slough off. So it's like a scab being peeled on your eyeball. It also causes an extremely rough surface, so just blinking is painful. She wears contact bandages basically 24/7, and that does allow for some smoothness of the eye. And all of that from a light bulb. Who would have thought? Go to a school gymnasium, go where you're supposed to be, an in-service training where you're learning to help teach others, and you end up being basically injured to the point of disability. She doesn't want to be disabled. She wants to be in the classroom. I've learned a lot about metal halide lights in the last 28 months. One thing I know is we don't need them. There are high output energy efficient fluorescent tubes. There are self-extinguishing bulbs. Basically, what you're looking at here is the filament. That's the part that creates ultraviolet radiation. This outside bulb is a UV filter. What happened in her case is that outside bulb was broken. So you had basically the power of the sun 20 feet over your head. There have been numerous incidents reported since 1962 to the FDA. The FDA does not require injuries from radiation to be reported. But I found a medical document that stated that between 62 and somewhere like 72, there were 695 cases of burns to the skin and eyes from these types of lights. I don't know if you folks, after I testified in February, I was contacted by a reporter for Associated Press, and she did a story on this accident and the bill, the Senate bill. And since that hit the AP wire, it was picked up by over 108 news organizations, and a lot of them included a link to the website that I built called UVLightBurns.com. And I have received emails and information about accidents as recently as last month in Mississippi, where 20 people at a boxing match were burned because a light bulb directly over their head was broken earlier in the week by a basketball. What I find most interesting about that article is that a representative of Philips, the manufacturer of the bulb that hurt my wife, stated that they're not claiming any responsibility, but they do not recommend that these bulbs are used in places where they can be damaged, like school gymnasiums. Yet, since these bulbs were first invented, that's where they've been used. The manufacturer is saying these shouldn't be used in schools, yet this is where we find them. And this is where people get hurt. Not just students, not just teachers, but community members who use those facilities for other purposes. Can you imagine a small school in Dufour, Oregon? The entire community gets together for a bingo game, and there's a broken bulb in there. You've just put the entire community in the hospital. It's time to get these things out of schools. It's time to prevent this type of senseless injury. And it's time to make change. I think that this is a common sense piece of legislature. I think it's pretty simple. The schools are already changing the lights. So what's the deal? We put a time limit on it. But what we're going to do when we do that is we're going to put a law in the books of Oregon that says these are not safe in Oregon schools. You know what that's going to do? It's going to give me the ability to go to the state of Washington and the state of Idaho and the state of Tennessee and say, why are you allowing these to be used in your schools? They're not legal in Oregon. Oregon has realized that this is a danger. We need to remove them from the schools. And I think in the very near future, you'll see me down here again, because I think these also need to be removed from Costco and Lowe's and all the other stores where they're used. This is just the tip of the iceberg. And I want something positive to come out of what has happened to my wife. I want to protect other people. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. LaFollette. Members will wait till we hear from all witnesses before we have questions. Ms. Rose, please.
Sorry. Yeah, my name is Cheryl Rhodes, and I am the PE teacher at Bryant. I was not at the in-service where they were, but the day that the light bulb was broken, I was not at school. I came to work for the next 3 weeks and worked underneath the bulb, not knowing that my eyes were being damaged, and I have over 32 and a half hours worth of exposure. On the day that I felt the exposure, I had gotten really tired. I went home. I went to sleep. I fell asleep on the couch with my contacts in, like 4.5 hours. I got up. Man, my eyes are sore. Went upstairs, you know, took them out, went to bed. Middle of the night, my eyes are frying, and I can't figure out what it is. Oh, I've fallen asleep. It must have been my, you know, tried the Visine, put them in there. They're burning away. Put the cloths on your eyes, and I sat there. And I thought, that's what it was. I had absolutely no idea that the light had anything to do with it. I ended up going to the doctor after the in-service and when everybody else got burned, because then I figured, oh, it's not just my contacts. I just didn't put them back in. I wore my glasses. It was fine. And then when everybody else was injured, you know, I went, whoa, it's that has to be it. So I ended up going to the same doctor, and lo and behold, it was the same thing. I thought I was getting better. They first told us it's going to be 48 hours. You'll be fine 48, 72 hours. Because that's normally what happens. The problem is, not only myself, but the other teachers that were in that in-service had more exposure than anyone has ever had before. The doctors don't know. They have absolutely no idea what is our prognosis. Everybody says, oh, it's going to get better. I'm feeling it's going to get better. It's been 2.5 years. This is how I live my life. My eyes no longer create any tears, naturally. So I have artificial plugs put in both in the tops and bottoms of my eyes. And I am with eye drops every hour and sometimes more, depending on if the air is circulating. You turn on air conditioners, you turn on the heater in your house, it dries it out. Anytime there's low humidity, then the eye drops have to go back in. And if they dry out, then they tear, then they burn. It's just an ongoing thing. Last year, I also had a growth on my left eyelid that had to be surgically removed. And then after that, one of the plugs became implanted, and I had to go to Casey and have surgery on that eye to take it out. We have gone through all kinds of things for them to help us, to the point where when you went to bed at night, you taped your eyes shut all night long just to see if they could keep the fluid in them so you could sleep, hopefully, all night. Every morning when you wake up, your eyes are crusted shut, and you have to use, you know, hot water, find your way in hot water to undo them. It's been a really life-changing experience as far as I'm concerned, my family, My husband, the first thing he ever asks me whenever he talks to me is, how are your eyes doing today? And he waits for the answer before he says, do you want to go do this or do you want to go do this? So oftentimes when we go someplace, I have to leave because the lights are too bright. Things that I've loved to do in the past, I just don't do anymore. I go outside maybe for little times. I have another pair of sunglasses that has two shields of dark sunglasses so I can be outside for a little while. However, that does weird things with the depth perception, and you're trying to do things, and I'm like sports, and my golf game is, you know, if I try it, it just doesn't, nothing is working anymore. The lights in my gym have been replaced. They took all of them out in all like Oswego. They didn't just replace the bulbs, they replaced the entire fixtures. We've turned half of them off. I have in the lights. They put a shield over the top to block it off, and I still have to wear sunglasses and a visor to go to work. And as a PE teacher, the kids are always moving things, throwing things up, and I'm having to look. Every time I look up, it goes into the light, and then the headaches come pretty much every day. Reading is difficult. Anything that I do to read makes it very hard. Working on a computer, doing lesson plans, trying to do report cards. I know if I do that, then I'll probably be in bed for the next day because it's just too hard, and it gives you that the light sensitivity gets worse. There are some days that are better than others, but you just don't know. The bulb that hit the light, that the volleyball that hit it, this bulb, he's my Vanna White here. The protective shield, as you see, you can't really tell. It doesn't have to be fully broken in order for UV light to come out. It just has to be cracked. And the only way to check these light bulbs is to get a lift, go all the way up to it, and check each bulb individually. Schools don't do that. You know? And being a PE teacher for 27 years, I'm sorry, balls hit light fixtures on a daily basis, beanbags, whatever the kids are doing. And not only inside where we know where they are, they're under covered areas, which are outside where no one is monitoring. And if someone hits a light bulb and you're in a basketball game, do they tell the custodian that night? No. They don't know. They don't know the dangers. And no one knows them. So you come and you go to work, and then this is what happens. And we just need to stop this from happening to anybody else. I want to protect the kids. The reason none of our kids were injured is because in PE classes, they move constantly. They're always in and out. It's the sitting down. If you were to sit, I was refereeing volleyball and standing one place teaching, you know, lummy stick activities on the days that I got the most exposure. But these bulbs are dangerous, and we do need to protect the students, teachers, and the public from needless harm. Requiring schools to change from these bulbs to a type T self-extinguishing bulb will keep anyone else from suffering a life-changing injury like mine. So I really urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lawrence. Ms. Guest.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Marianne Guest representing Oregon School Employees Association. After listening to the testimony, there's not much to add other than to say these injuries are preventable. Our children and our employees should not be operating or working and going to school in these buildings that have these type of lights, and we support the bill 100%. I'm not even sure there should be a delay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Guest. Representative Dolan.
Yeah, with the compelling testimony.
Sorry.
And it indeed was compelling testimony. Why are we not, and you talked about commercial use of the bulbs. Why isn't the bill expanded to include places where the public goes to not only school activities, but to recreate, to shop? Why the delimited exclusion?
Anytime you tear a mountain down, you do it one piece at a time. You got to work for what you can really achieve. And I think this is something that, first of all, it's fresh in everybody's mind, the injury. It's something that the schools are already doing. They know the danger. And I think it's a place to start. And like I said, it's not where we're going to finish, but it's a start. One thing you need to know, especially about this particular bulb right here that I hold in my hand, I got this from a friend of ours who bought light fixtures on the secondary market, used light fixtures to put up in his barn. He installed those light fixtures in his barn. He was admiring his work, and the next day he woke up with burns to his skin and his eyes. He did an internet search, and he found my website. I hadn't talked to him in years. He called us on the phone crying. We sent him to our doctor. He took these things out of his barn, and he bought self-extinguishing bulbs. These things, that's my main concern. When these things come out of the schools, and they end up in a salvage yard, and somebody decides that they want to put them in their writing arena or something like that, we haven't eliminated the problem. We've just moved it. But by taking them out of schools...
That's my point.
Now you're going to require private industry to pay the cost of changing them out.
I'm going to support this piece of legislation, but if it had an amendment to it that these were to be removed and destroyed, I'd be far more comfortable. I don't think we want to. I'll go with you. Move them out in a piece at a time, but. We have a lot more people that are suffering exposure than just in schools.
I've received emails from a guy that worked at Lowe's, and he said that part of his job was to replace these lights after they ran into him with forklifts. And he couldn't figure out why he was having problems being out in the sunshine, and his eyes were bothering him, and his eyes were always dry, and his doctor hadn't been able to help him. They didn't understand. They didn't relate the two things. And that's the sad part. Construction workers. I mean, I'm getting all sorts of emails from these people that have been injured and they've read this article, and they finally have something to base their injury on. They know what happened to them now.
So. Additional questions? Representative Lim.
Yes, I was out for a while. Maybe has been discussed, but my question is, why do they use the stadium field and on the athletic field?
Well,
when that doesn't function, they take out the bulb. And where do they store that? Where do they put it?
Where do they store the bulbs after that?
Yes, when it's not used.
Well, stadium lighting, as my understanding, is a different wattage, and a lot of them have gone to a different type of lighting. The other thing you have to remember is when you're talking about outdoor lighting, if a bulb is broken and is emitting ultraviolet radiation, the distance that you are from that bulb is probably not going to cause you any harm at all. The only person that's going to get hurt is if they leave it on when they go to change it, and that's when you're going to get exposed because of your proximity to the bulb.
Okay. Thank you.
I thank you all for your time.
Mr. LaFollette and Ms. Rose, I'm extremely sorry for the misfortune that you've suffered, and thank you so much for coming forward today.
Mr. Wilson, do you have any additional testimony?
Is there one other person who registered to testify, David Furr?
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, compelling testimony in my sympathies and respect to the affected people by this accident. I'm here to offer a little bit different perspective, perhaps. Just as they spoke from their experience, so I must speak from mine. I am the utilities coordinator for Salem-Keizer Public Schools. As such, I'm basically the energy manager for the school district. I work a lot with lighting as we go through and explore ways to save energy and reduce our energy costs.
Mr. Excuse me, did you already say your name for the record?
Oh, sorry, David Furr, F-U-R-R.
Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm.
In our district, we have 77 sites, 69 of which are schools. These buildings comprise a total of approximately 5.1 million square feet. Since 2005, actually since 2004, we have begun replacing metal halide lighting in gyms and common areas. Specifically, we have completed projects at 52 of those sites for the sake of energy efficiency. We've removed about 1,500 fixtures with 250-watt or 400-watt metal halide lamps. These were all R-type. We replaced them with new fixtures containing T5HO fluorescent lamps and also added occupancy sensors for an extra boost of energy efficiency. And we've realized a 30 to 50% energy savings for the same amount of light. It's better quality lighting, and we have reduced maintenance demands as a result of this newer technology.
Mr. Furt, so if I can, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but I just need to clarify, are you speaking on behalf of the district, or are you speaking just personally? I just need to try to clarify.
I'm speaking on behalf of the district, I suppose.
Thank you very much.
Sure. However, we still have more than 470 metal halide fixtures of varying wattages, ranging from 50 watts to 200 watts in use. And these are mostly in our parking lots, security lighting. There are some in hallways and lobbies, exterior soffits around our buildings, and outdoor covered play areas. Almost all of them, if not all of them, are enclosed fixtures. That is, the bulb is enclosed within a metal and glass enclosure. The only available T-type metal halide bulb replacements that I have been able to get information on from two different suppliers that we use are for 400-watt fixtures. Given this limitation, if we are not able to receive T-type replacements in these other wattages, we would have to additionally replace, convert all of these fixtures at roughly at a cost of $200 to $300 per item. That would be, in our case, approximately $100,000 to $150,000 for the district changeout. Those would have to go to different technologies. You cannot put a different type. You cannot put a non-metal halide bulb into a metal halide fixture. It requires a change out either of the ballast or a replacement of the entire fixture. We believe that what is, in my experience, an extremely remote likelihood of injury resulting from broken and unshielded metal halide lamps does not warrant legislation exclusively requiring schools to conform to a lighting standard which currently no other entity must meet. However, if it must be so, we respectfully request that the proposed Senate Bill 479A be amended to exempt all enclosed metal halide fixtures as recommended by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in the attached pages which follow my remarks. Also, consider exempting fixtures serving areas which are not commonly occupied for extended periods. For example, half hour, 30 minutes. Regarding some of the other testimony, and just offering this as a point of information, the ultraviolet light is not necessarily harmful. What is harmful is the shortwave ultraviolet light, and that is what has caused the injuries to the people who testified just before me and to others. The purpose of the glass shield around the light-emitting source within that bulb is to filter out those shortwave ultraviolet lights, rays, excuse me. In our athletic fields, And in most districts that I'm aware of, there are metal halide fixtures. I don't know of any personally and in conversation with other facility staff in districts around the state. I don't know of any athletic fields that have high-pressure sodium fixtures. Or they're all either incandescent or metal halide. The reason for this is, again, the metal halide is a good source of light. It is a bright point source of light, as opposed to a fluorescent lamp, which is not a point source. It's a light source which is extended over a larger area. The tube is larger. And also the light which comes from it is good for rendering colors. It shows colors very effectively compared to a high-pressure sodium, which is the orange light which you might see in some parking lots, or the yellow light which shines. And it's difficult to distinguish colors under that type of lighting, more difficult in any way than with metal halide. So if one is taking pictures under that kind of light, one would get a muddier photograph than if one were using a metal halide fixture, or in the case of some of the newer fluorescents, a better quality light would, or photo would also be available there. I'm ambivalent about this. We, as a district, are ambivalent about this legislation. We are sensitive to the needs of and the safety of our students and of other people who must work under metal halide lighting. I would just as soon see us, as my CFO says, get out of the metal halide business. Because from my point of view, they're energy hogs, and I would like to see more and a better performance in our schools. However, there is a cost associated, and for us, I'm sure we would meet those costs, certainly, if it's legislated for us to do so. We may be able to do so with less trouble, perhaps, than some other districts in the state, just simply because of our size and our resources that are available to us. And I guess that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fur. Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In closing, the USDA has asked us to do, if you have an enclosure, almost all of the ones in gyms that I know of have some kind of metal enclosure. That doesn't mean that they don't get broke from time to time, because the enclosure rattles and they break. So I don't know that that would solve the problem. And if we made that exclusion, we might be excluding exactly the kinds of facilities that this was going after.
That may be the case.
And my follow-up would be, in some of these outdoor enclosures, like the ones that, you know, maybe a covered place for kids to be in, you may have teachers or assistants that would be asked to be on duty for an extended period of time, and you could have one broken, and they would be in the same place. And I'm thinking the $141,000 here, as opposed to the liability issue, the $141,000 seems a lot more than one incident with somebody getting hurt.
That's a good point, sir. In covered play areas, we have fixtures which are of a lower wattage. They're mounted to the underside of the roof of the play structure. It is a high-impact safety enclosure which protects the bulb inside. There is no movement from this fixture. It is attached to the structure itself. The purpose of that, of course, is just to protect the light source and to prevent this from happening.
Representative Greenlee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm not sure I understand why why there aren't T-type self-extinguishing bulbs in lower wattage. Why would you have them only at 400 and not?
Good question, sir. I was scratching my head on that one, too.
Not available anywhere. Is that what you're saying?
I did find a reference to one on the Internet after going through several pages of leads on that, I did find one reference to a 250-watt T-type. It was from a Chinese manufacturer, and it was not listed from a distributor or a U.S. manufacturer, and there was only one. I found references to T-type halogen bulbs, but those would not work in a metal halide fixture, and it simply referred to the type of mounting, which was a T-shaped type of mounting which held the unit itself and was not a self-extinguishing type of reference. It's confusing. It confused me.
Well, I'm not confused. I'm
okay.
Bemused.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dahlin.
Yeah, with the... I'm thinking of days gone by. And mom and dad and the kid in my superintendent's office and me explaining why I didn't change these bulbs or fixtures or the roof, for that matter, when I knew that their child might be exposed. I have no place to go. I now know. You now know. You have much room to move in.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Ms. Furr. Appreciate
you very much.
Can I ask one question?
Elizabeth Crumley, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long does an R-type metal halide bulb usually last?
They're rated for the industry rating is 20 to 22,000 hours.
And a T-type?
I don't know the rating on that. I would presume it would be the same. I'm assuming that the difference between them is simply a safety feature and it's not a performance feature.
Representative Roebling.
Thank you. If this bill were to pass out of the legislature today, how long would it take you to replace all the facilities?
Speaking for our district, we would move with considerable haste to get it done. We would certainly have it done by the timeline. What is it, June 08?
But could it be done sooner, do you think?
Oh, yes. It likely would be so.
90 days?
Perhaps.
Okay, that's Thank you, Mr. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I have just one more question.
Well, I'm sorry, Representative Lim.
Thank you very much.
The visual cues here.
Thank you. I'm not quite familiar with it. Do they use this T-type metal highlight or mercury vapor like bulb? Do they use in their resident area at all? In the house or just around the house?
The only metal halide lamp that I'm aware of that's for residential use is a small bulb-shaped item which has a frosted shell which will screw into, I believe, a conventional light fixture. I've not used them because, and I don't think a lot of other people have either, because the quality of light is different than one gets from either a fluorescent or an incandescent bulb. I don't know if it's a T-type, but I do know that some of the yard lights are metal halides and some of the area lights are metal halides. Those are exterior applications.
So follow up, Mr. Paul. Since residence is very low compared to the gym outside, and it could be harmful to the children when they play underneath the light?
If the protective sheathing around the light source is damaged, yes. It could be, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Dahl.
Curious question. I remember it seems to me these lights replaced the mercury vapor lights.
Yes.
What happened to them?
The mercury vapor lights?
Mm-hmm.
In our district, I think we have only five that I know of, and those are going to be replaced this summer for efficiency purposes primarily. The metal halides were brought in to replace the mercury vapors just because of the quality of light was much improved. Mm-hmm. And also brought in to replace some of the larger 8-foot T12, the fat tube fluorescent lights as well. Same reason.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burr.
Thanks, Scott.
I believe that fulfills our list of witnesses. Members, we are in a work session. And I, because I did open a public hearing and work session on the bill, and I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
And I believe we can do that. We've done this in rules consistently.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, yes.
I will vote against the bill because I want to amend it. If you want to amend it to 90 days or 120.
Senator Devlin, since we are in a work session, if you come join us and...
I don't want to expose the schools or myself to longer possibility of damage.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Donovan.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I understand why we start with a public facility, but I would like to look at an amendment that would include destruction of the present facility. I'm not too fussy to see them growing up in a barn or a garage or any other place. So I have no problem with the bill. I just wonder if we're going far enough.
Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, both Representative Wisnett and Representative Dallin, a couple of issues here. First of all, I think the wholesale market that's out there for the type R bulbs isn't really probably so much bulbs that are being resold that were previously used. It's simply that there are a lot of bulbs that are manufactured that are sitting in warehouses. That would have been part of the testimony that you may have heard if the party had more time here that was testifying after me. They would also testify that the actual difference in cost of manufacture between the bulbs is about 5 cents in the cost to manufacture the extinguishable versus the non-extinguishable. Being in this building a little time, I know that you cannot amend probably conceptually, or if you attempt to, legislative council will be here before I can finish the next sentence. I think we have heard testimony that this will be done in all due haste in most school districts. I can understand Representative Wisnett's concern, but as any representative or senator that's in this building, my hope is always to move a bill out, particularly when we have about 8 weeks left starting on Monday, and to improve it at a later date if we need to. Now, in terms of the deadline, that's a relatively easy amendment, and I have some of the people behind me from the school boards. I do not know if they would have any concern about such an amendment. One of the things that we tried to follow was the school year. And so what I would suggest if you were to amend it is that you gave them at least until the end of the first coming semester that would begin in September. So until December of this year, or to the end of December. Because in trying to do legislation with schools, I've always tried to work with them and be reasonable understanding, you know, what some of their pressures are, and trying to find legislation that we can work on cooperatively. And we settled on this date. But if the committee is so strongly feeling about this that it should be sooner, I would suggest that you request such an amendment. But that would probably delay the consideration of the bill.
Mr. Williams, would you join us, please?
just Representative Robin. Just so you know, I'm trying to keep him down to within 30 days.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. We would obviously prefer that you pass the bill in its current form. I think that pressures being what they are in the building, you might have a lot of other work to get to, and we'd like to get this bill to the governor's desk as soon as possible so we can start working with districts on replacing those lights. I think you've heard great testimony about districts who are being aggressive, and given the passage of this, will not wait until next year to do it. They'll do it with all due haste was the word used, and we will certainly encourage districts in that endeavor. We did appreciate that the senator, working with a sort of school calendar, kept that view towards the whole entire school year so that districts can build this into their planning. But I can guarantee you that this is happening around the state already. Districts are removing those, and frankly, the trigger for that was the letter from Occupational Safe and Healthy, Health and Safety, which they probably, I can guarantee you, the next phone call to the superintendent was from risk management saying, you need to get rid of these lights now. So I can pretty much say they are happening. We support the bill and would encourage you to vote aye on it today and move it out to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Representative McPherson, would you care to join us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I really don't need to add anything particular to what these gentlemen have already provided. Have you spoken yet, Mr. Senator Devlin?
Oh, several times.
Oh, very good. Both of us. So I will just add my presence to the importance that I think should be attached to this bill.
Thank you. Representative Wisden.
You might remind the representative, our issue is not whether to pass the bill. It's the issue is whether we're waiting too long to implement it.
That is the concern before the committee at present, that whether the deadline date of July 2008 is leaves people at risk for too great a period of time, trying to balance that against the ability for school districts to legitimately have a chance to.
And we heard testimony from an expert who said he could do it in
less than the time needed.
Less than 120 days.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Was that Dylan?
Yes, my question would be for OSBA again. You have a regular system for notifying schools. Through OSBA, have you notified all of your member schools?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallum, it is my, and I apologize, I'm actually filling in for Jim Green, who has been our expert on the bill, but my understanding is that through the vehicle that we have is a property and casualty trust that does property and casualty insurance for school districts, and I believe that they in fact have notified districts even prior, I believe it was prior to this session even, about the need to remove these bulbs.
But when we hear this compelling testimony, and whether it, to me it's not a property and casualty issue at all, this is a human issue, and so I'm asking you, as a school board association, disregarding whether I have legal exposure, I have a human exposure. Have you notified your schools that they should be doing this for human reasons?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallum, I don't believe that the association has notified districts to this point other than what I previously mentioned.
Do you agree that this is a compelling issue?
I would fully agree with that.
Do you think that you should maybe notify your school districts of this compelling issue?
I couldn't agree more.
Do you know of any school districts that would not respond if you gave them notice of the danger involved?
None off the top of my head.
Will you be notifying your school districts?
You bet.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dolan. Members, I'm going to suggest, Representative Lim, perhaps with a solution that might make Mr. Williams' life harder, I'm going to suggest that we do amend the bill to, as Senator Devlin suggested, perhaps December 31st of this year. Giving the school districts at least that time to do so. And Senator Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I am not an attorney, obviously, and I have an attorney sitting next to me.
That's always helpful.
And I believe the drafter of this is Ms. Hunt. And I believe by the time, if you took out Section 3,
correct,
and made Section 4, I'm just reading through very quickly, so I'm not sure. And made that Section 3, the operative date of this bill would be the same as any other bill that we pass, would be January 1st of the next year.
That's correct. But at that point, we would not have given the districts a deadline, as I understand the bill.
It would become effective on July 1, 2007, and if 1 year from the date from the effective date of this bill would be July 1, 2008, they would have to have the lights changed out by.
With 1 year. I got you. I see what you're saying.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, you would be taking out Section 3. We probably should just get Legislative Council to do this. Take out Section 3 and change the effective date to
Next counsel is out sick today. Ms. Hunt, our counsel is out sick. I'd be happy to amend this bill in a way that works and get it back. I don't think this amendment will take long for Ms. Hunt to do, and we'll get it back for our committee and we'll get it passed onto the floor. Okay. I think we have overwhelming support for the bill.
Yeah, I mean, I have no problem with that, except, it'll still be much quicker, even with a concurrence vote back in the Senate, than it would be to wait for the extra 6 months. So, yeah, it's still faster. It's good.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate the sense of urgency that the committee feels on this issue. I mean, it was put into such dramatic focus by this terrible event that happened in the districts that Representative Senator Devlin and I each represent.
Representative Lynn. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask one question. Are you able to do this job done within the limit resources is available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I believe that Representative Dahlem hit it on the head when he said that this really is a compelling human issue, and I think that districts will find a way to replace these light bulbs if they have not already done that. I think it was said earlier the notion of doing inventory and finding how many are out there. I think we'll find that a substantial majority of districts have already begun that conversion and built it into their budgeting process already.
Thank you.
Good policy.
Thank you, Representative. Representative McPherson, I'm sorry, we pulled you in the work session. We didn't give you a chance to introduce yourself for the record. So
for the record, Mr. Chair, Greg McPherson, House District 38, representing Lake Oswego and part of Southwest Portland, and it is at Bryant Elementary School in Lake Oswego that this the incident that gave rise to this bill occurred.
Thank you so much. Committee, you're comfortable with the direction we're heading with this? Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing work session on House Bill 479A, and I'll request Mr. Olson to work with us to make sure that change gets made with legislative council. I'd like to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 242A. And Mr. Olson, if you'd remind us what this is about, and Senator Devlin, if you'll join us at the desk again.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 242A requires school districts to evaluate the need for safety improvements for safer routes to school prior to entering into contracts for large construction projects. Requires school districts to consider funding such safety improvements within the funding of large construction projects and evaluate potential joint funding for such safety improvements. Defines large construction project as projects for which the total bonded indebtedness is greater than $1 million. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's been a long time. I'm pleased to be here today to support Senate Bill 242. Members of the committee, this came to you on a unanimous vote out of the Senate Education and General Government Committee and a vote of 22-5 on the Senate floor. I've been working on this bill for about 3 years, actually. It passed overwhelmingly in the last Senate session, and I've made some revisions to it, and it passed overwhelmingly again this session in the Senate. And I'm hoping that you can support it. This bill actually brings people to a point of simply asking some questions and then leaving them all the choices up to them. The bill would simply require a school district that is planning a major construction project and seeking public approval of a bond measure greater than $1 million to evaluate the need for safety improvements within 1 mile of an elementary school or 1.5 miles of a secondary school. They would also evaluate the potential for joint funding with other public and private entities for those safety improvements. They would consider the cost of these, including these safety improvements, within the funding of the larger project. And they would include in the public record the issues considered and decision made by the local school board in this action. Under this legislation, the local school district determines both the process followed and ultimately what decision is made. So ultimately, all of the decision rests with the school board. It is simply asking them to make the evaluation. You might ask why this is important. Well, in 2005, pedestrian incidents leading to cause of accidental deaths are the most significant cause of death for children between the ages of 5 and 14, the very children that are walking back and forth to school. In Oregon, we do not normally provide transportation to students who live within either a mile of an elementary school or a mile and a half of a secondary school. I believe, as I believe many of you do, that we have some responsibility for the safety of those students. often after the fact, after you've built the building, it is not as easy to look at or have the resources to do some of the safety improvements that might be necessary. So this bill would simply require for major renovation or new construction for them to examine safe routes for children to take to school and consider what improvements might be necessary. Some of the issues that school districts might find are a lack of safe paths or sidewalks. And I have to forgive myself for keeping this in my testimony, sidewalks, because a few representatives, and well, let me look at my representative Dallum, might say sidewalks are only in some portions of Oregon. But,
only but in some almost, portions of my district.
Yes, they might also find...
We have two sidewalks in our district.
They might also find visibility issues, inadequate warning signs, etc. Often also the congestion that is close to schools where students arrive by car, bus, walking, or bicycling often sets up issues relative to children's safety. They might also find some visibility issues that could be easily corrected. I have worked with the OEA, the Oregon School Boards Association, and COSA on this legislation. And in fact, one of the parties that was on the Senate committee who voted against the legislation in the last session voted for this legislation for the very reason that I removed from it projects that were that did not require a bond measure. Because I originally had in this projects that were greater than $500,000 that did not require a bond measure. And what we talked about, and I've talked to a lot of people about, is I had never intended this to apply to a school district that is saving up operating resources to replace a roof. I'm only asking that when they go out for a bond measure, when they go out and decide to either totally renovate a school building or build a new school building, that they look at the safe routes that children will have to go in either that mile and a mile and a half distance and do what they believe is necessary. I'm not dictating a standard. I'm just asking them to look at the issue. The bill before you is supported by the OEA, the OSBA, the Oregon School Employees Association, and the Traffic Safety Division of ODOT has given supportive testimony in previous hearings.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Devlin, with regards to this, you mentioned that you're not mandating a standard, but yet, aren't most local governments already going to be looking at what the road standard is around the area where a school is going to be going in, and if it requires two lane, three lane, four lane, you know, five lane, whatever the lane construction is, plus bicycle lanes, plus walkways, and that sort of thing. I mean, that's already going to be coming under consideration as far as the local government's concerned, right?
Under new construction in some cities and in some unincorporated areas, a lot of those factors would come into play in determining road size and determining the size and necessity for traffic devices, sidewalks, etc. But often what we find in school safety issues within a mile and a mile and a half of schools are relatively sometimes things that are easy to correct, things that would never be considered, the obstacle in a particular area that could easily be removed, the sight distance that isn't there, that a few bushes could be removed and regraded and basically affect a change. I think one of the things that you find, though, is after the fact, is usually a lot of times you don't have the resources. And from your previous experience and my previous experience being on city councils, we also know that many times when you have to go in and you can need to do an additional project, many times it's many partners that come to play in doing that additional project. It might be the city. Many of us actually have state facilities going through our towns. It might be the state. It might be a local development interest that is doing something. And actually, having the school district be able to come to the table with some resources to get an improvement is often very helpful and something that they often don't really have the extra resources to do. But if they considered this at the time they were doing a bond measure, I believe that they would.
Representative Rilbo.
Yeah, a couple comments, and thank you, Mr. Yeah. Chair. I wish we could go both ways, so that not only when schools are planning doing it, when cities are planning to do things, they would have to come to the school district and say it. Because, you know, in our local water district, I found out that when ODOT is doing road construction or the city is, they've got a cooperative agreement that they come to the water board, because if there's pipes that will be changed, it's nice to do it when you're carrying up the road to put the new pipe underneath where the old road was at the same time, because then you don't have to tear up the new road right afterwards to fix the pipe. So cooperative things really work well. And the other part that's really hard, all of my cities are on 101. And I was really pleased to hear that ODOT was in support of this, because the conversations that we've had in a couple of our cities in getting another stoplight to go across Highway 101 when there's a stoplight within X number of blocks is almost impossible. And we've been doing it for a number of years in one of our communities, trying to find a way to have another stoplight, because the schools, the whole new complex went in, and then comprehensive city plans have to be changed. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into some what we think would be a simple decision, because the city's already got a plan. That plan has to be revised in order to do that, and that has to there's a lot of planning that goes into these things. So I guess what I'm saying is I support the bill and the idea of the bill. I think what school districts will find is it's a lot easier to have control over their own things than it is on all these other people. But if we get more of them working together to solve these problems, I think we'll have a better and safer way for kids to go. It's just, I've been frustrated.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roblin and also Representative Crummell, I might comment, because sometimes when you're sitting in these chairs, you sometimes have feeling of deja vu. several sessions back, and if you look in ORS on the respective session, and I can't cite it by heart, I was sitting at a table just like this, and I was sitting in the middle, and Mr. Chandler was on one side of me, and Mr. Conkling was on the other side of me. And if you look at the section of ORS now that calls for cooperation between school districts and local governments in planning, I'm the author of much of that, or one of the authors of much of that legislation.
There's a wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to hear from OSBA again, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Williams has not signed up to testify, but I'm sure he'd be glad to come forward should you have some questions for him on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator, again, great, you know, I'm okay with the concept. I got number problems again.
Yeah.
And I think these numbers are a little small. I haven't talked to my school districts to see, but, you know, $1 million doesn't get you much anymore. Yeah. And neither does $500,000. And very few bonds that measure.
That's why I don't think it's a problem, because I don't think you'd put a bond up
to that. Yeah. Be that low. Well, but the point is, if you're doing something for $1 million, it may not be much, but then you got to do the safety fence. Probably no more than a roof or something. Yeah. If you're doing that, and I think that's where, I think if you're building a new building, a new classroom, a new gym, but, you know, some of the projects now that are going to get higher, I just don't know if you're putting a burden on the school districts. And
Senator Deller?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnant, we've discussed this actually with the OSBA. I think the expectation is, obviously, very few people go out for bonds that are that low, and the trigger is that if they're above that level, they would go through this process. As you know, most people would be going out for bonds. Probably, I think the lowest bond I've ever seen is about $5 million.
Yes, sir.
And in your district, knowing some of the pressures that you have in Deschutes County, I'm sure your bonds are in the tens of millions
30s,
of dollars.
And more than 30s.
Yes.
But thank you, Ms. Senator. But again, I think your or B, so B kicks in too. If you're putting, you know, a new roof on a building or a gym, you wouldn't need to have a change or safety plan for that. I'll trust that OSBA checked with Deschutes County and they were okay. But.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm happy you brought this bill. I've talked about secure routes to schools for a long time and in my campaigns and with my constituents, because as we do away with PE more and more, this getting kids to walk to school may be the only exercise they're going to have during the day. But interestingly, one of the things that some of my mom's brought up in discussion about a secure route to school doesn't have to do with physical security. It has to do with
protecting their kids against weird people along the way. And it seemed to me one of the considerations we need to be talking about when we're talking about secure rights to school is extra police protection, or at least police presence in the area, so that the parents feel safe sending their 10-year-olds off on a bike to get to school. I mean, and I think it's a legitimate consideration in this day and age.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, I think it obviously is a serious consideration for many parents, and I'm trying to address simply part of the issue. It's actually a very sad commentary that parents have that concern.
Awful.
I think all of us here are, maybe not. All of us here are of an age that I don't think when we went to school we really had those kind of concerns. In fact, I've got a daughter that when she went to school, I didn't have those kinds of concerns.
But it is the sort of thing when we're talking about secure routes to school, we really want to be talking about this kind of psychological security of the routes as well as the physical security. And you're right, this is a piece of the issue.
I just want to make a statement, though, that on this group, we may not be young enough, but there are members who walk to school, even though they were at a younger age, through snow and everything. Representative Clem walked to school every day.
The snow was over my head every day.
I know I live 2 blocks from
Thank you, members.
We have
two more witnesses to cover on this piece of legislation. Senator Devlin, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. And we have Scott Bricker and Lori Wilmer-Whalen.
Mr. Chairman, I have to go testify on some disability legislation, developmentally disabled, on the budget. So.
Senator, we'll try not to mess with this one. We'll try to see if we can just...
But if we do, you'll be... We'll let you know.
And Representative, did you want OSBA to come up as well?
I'd be happy to invite them.
No, we got it. All right.
Welcome.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Brecker, and I work on bicycle and pedestrian issues. So I represent the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, both nonprofit organizations, and we are trying to increase bicycling walking to school. So it hasn't been that often. You wouldn't expect to see bicycling and walking folks in front of the education committee, although 30 years ago, 50% of children did walk to school, and within a mile, over 90% of children walked to school. And that number is larger as you go back in time, where today it's less than 15%. I know your committee has been hearing a lot of information and a lot of work about trying to increase healthy and active children and the issue of health and youth obesity and the lack of resources. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance and Lyme Pedestrian Coalition are trying to work to increase bicycling walking to school, to increase youth physical activity, to increase the health of children. And the Safe Routes to School effort is a really important way to get there. So we support Senate Bill 242 strongly. A little bit of background, and actually there were some really great points perhaps I could try and talk about as well in my testimony. Children within a mile of elementary schools or a mile and a half of middle schools are not supposed to or won't be bused by school districts. However, there are many, many districts, many, many schools that file supplemental plans that permit that busing. And the state spends well over $200 million a year busing children. The state spends covers 70 to 90% of that spending of the cost. So the total is actually more like $300 million. You guys perhaps know that number better than I, but it's an expensive issue. And on any given day, 50% of the kids that get to school are actually driven by parents or driven in the car. So the traffic congestion and the issues related to school and school transportation are significant. In fact, there have been a number of studies that have shown that 20% of the morning traffic is related to taking kids places, taking kids to school. So what have we been doing to try and deal with that issue? Actually, since 2001, we've been working at the legislative level. In 2001, we helped pass what's now ORS 195.115, and this is on the second page of my testimony. And actually, that Now, law requires that cities and school districts work together to identify the barriers and hazards to children walking or bicycling to and from school, and states that they may develop a plan for funding the improvements. This bill, in our belief, basically gets that may on new buildings to a must. And that is a really important effort. I've attached a 11 by 17, which talks about some engineering improvements that could be done. Things like speed bumps cost $2,000 a bump. Traffic signals cost a lot more, $250,000, and there are obviously other improvements that could be done within that range. But in the city of Portland, and there are actually other communities, Bend, a number of other communities around the state that have already picked up the Safe Routes to School program concept, has found that to create one of these plans, it takes about 20 to 40 hours of engineering time. So that's anywhere between $2,000 and $5,000. So this is a modest investment for a multi-million dollar facility that could potentially save the state lots of money. I don't have a quantifiable number. It could be maybe one bus. I mean, it could be the health of children. This is a prudent measure to take if you're developing a new school to look at how you get kids there. In 2005, we continued to work on this and passed House Bill 2742, which created a Safe Routes to School program, which is housed at the Transportation Safety Division at ODOT. And right now, they have $4.4 million of federal funds that we helped lobby through the SafeTLU, which is the transportation bill at congressional bill, to actually fund programs that include not only infrastructure but the other issues, enforcement and encouragement. And actually, to get to Representative Greenlick's issue about stranger danger, some of those things include a walking school bus or bicycling school train. There are actually programs where parents walk children to school, and instead of a yellow bus going by your house, parent and children go by your house and children come on to that walking school bus. Okay. So this effort does include additional components. I don't know how exactly that would fit into this bill, but there are other things going on. So we strongly support this effort and hope that that the committee will pass it out of committee today, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bridges. Mr. Will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing Oregon Education Association, its 46,000 members, and this is our second session, heartily supporting this concept, and we do support Senate Bill 242 as it's come to you. We believe that the genius of it is the local flexibility that this bill offers districts to work with their local issues, concerns, barriers, and so on. We agree that children who walk or bicycle to school may face increased risk due to dangerous roadways, which often lack adequate sidewalks, include high traffic, and may feature low visibility. Roadways near schools choked with traffic from those parents who are driving their kids to school also exacerbate the problem. And so because one of our four fundamental areas in our legislative program is children's health and safety, we are very much in support of offering those kinds of legislative guidance measures that will give districts maximum flexibility and yet really underscore with a bright yellow line how important this is. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we do have two other bills there. It should be short ones, but if you do have questions, I'd be glad to entertain questions at this point. Representative Dahl?
You're going to bring this into work session today?
That's my plan.
Okay. Then I do have a question.
I just wanted to ask whether we can get blinking red lights for walking school buses. Ways to get traffic to...
Well,
Representative Dahl? That's not this bill.
Let me take Representative Dahl's question first.
And one other thing, and I'm going back to my district to... The city project, probably not a very good one anyway. in the largest city in my district, the public works manager sits on the school board. In the smallest of my districts, I know that even when we would remove two squares of sidewalk to put a pipe under, we'd work with the city, and several small cities come to mind. So what I'm asking, is there any place that doesn't presently do this? Who are we targeting here?
Chair Buckley, Vice Chair Dullum, this is a really interesting issue from my standpoint. Most of the time I spend following transportation policy at the city, regional, state, and federal level. And and virtually none of those places are, for example, school bus providers or school districts at the table. School districts have a completely different set of board of directors or governors than cities and counties do. And actually, in our experience, there is a significant disconnect between the two entities. If you think about the fact that $300 million of Oregon's tax money is spent on school busing every year, and then you think about the public transportation services in Oregon every year, school bus providers are actually probably the largest transit entity in every single city except for Portland.
But to the point, please.
So to the point, I do think that there is a lack of connection between the school transportation agencies being at the table and school and cities being at the table when siting of schools is happening. The siting and schools are being sited outside of where residential areas, schools are closing and being consolidated, and the issue of transportation.
But to the point, I hear all of your facts and figures. What I want to know is what school district, and I'm the largest ones I know, what school district does not, when they do a project, meet with the city, the county, and the state? Because that's what this bill does. This doesn't bus kids. It says when you build a school, you will provide a safe way to school. And that has merit. But what I'm asking, in my experience, I know of none that do not do that. So I'm asking, where is this not done?
Chair Buckley, Vice Chair Dahlem, I'll have to come back with specific examples. In my experience, it's actually the opposite. I ask questions of when is that coordination present. When schools are closed, I think of the city of Ashland. I know that there's Ashland Public Schools closed a number of schools, and there was discussion with the city and with the residents, but the school boards decided they were going to do that from their perspective. And I think about the city of Portland. So
I understand that, but yeah, this bill directs itself to construction. And
yes,
and I'm visualizing a roofing project with trucks and kids coming to school, and I hear your point. I don't want to be abrupt, but I hear your point. What I'm looking for when schools do a building project, where are the ones that do not coordinate with the other governmental units on this specific issue?
Thank you, Representative. I don't think Mr. Bricker is the witness who would have that information for you.
Sponsors.
I think Representative Roblin might want to be responding to this. Representative Roblin.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that we built a new building at our high school, and we coordinated while the building was going on with everybody to get stuff there, and it was kind of an amazing deal when you're building a building inside of all your other buildings. But we really didn't have any coordination with the city with respect to, while we were doing that, could we have also made new improvements on how they got to our school, which is what this bill is saying. It's not about during the construction are we doing it, but as we're going to get ready for the construction, did we meet with the city and say, you know, there's no sidewalks over here on this part of the deal. We'll work with you, but we need to get sidewalks because that's what most of the kids that are walking are coming this way, and the way they get there now is through this mud and whatever, and so a lot of kids don't do that when it's a rainy day and they move out onto the street and XYZ. That would have been good things to think about. And so I hope that, as I understand this bill, what we're really saying is, in that mile radius, are there ways in which we could make the safe trip to school a better trip, given coordination with cities and others, while this construction is going on? Or if we're building a whole new building, let's think about that mile radius so that we encourage people, once the construction is done, to walk to the school. And I guess with that, finally, I'll say my one other thing I want to say, because it co-aligns with that. My first public service job was when I was in fifth grade and sixth, being a patrol person at my school and having my own flag and getting to school early, running to school early, so I could get my flag and get back out at the cross street, because I've always lived on 101, and it went right by my school. It was up in northern Washington, but it was still 101, same street I'm on now. And so we had kids that were
400 miles south.
Yeah. We had, you know, part of the job, and I don't see that very much anymore because we don't, the liability and all that kind of stuff. But having that person standing out there with a flag and escorting all their friends that were coming to school across those streets encouraged people to walk. And I think, you know, we've given up a lot of the things, and we need to start talking about how we grow that community. I was really happy to hear the walking buses, those other kinds of things as well. But if we don't have safe ways for those walking buses to go, it's going to be hard to keep encouraging them. So Thanks. Is that? Yeah.
Representative Greenock, did you have, did you want to talk about walking school buses? Are you okay?
Oh, no. It's just something that intrigued me.
Yeah.
A message for a different day.
Very good.
Yeah, flashing red lights for walking school buses on a different bill.
Representative Lim.
Thank you. In the bill, section 1, subsection 2, and A, it's a 1 mile and a 1.5 mile. Is this a 1 mile or 1.5 mile whole radius, whole places, or just that where the construction area is just going through? Because according to this bill, it's a whole 1 mile radius.
Chair.
Are you comfortable answering that? Chair Buckley, Representative Lim, let me take a crack at that. My understanding is that it's a radius from the school.
Right.
That is a radius that when a school district decides what their transportation plan is going to be, they draw that radius around the school, and they don't include children that are bused within that radius unless there's a supplemental plan submitted. I think this bill, that's my understanding, I think this bill follows suit on what the current law is on school transportation procedure.
So this is already current.
The transportation law is currently in place that if a child lives within 1 mile of an elementary school, transportation will not be provided by the district, 1.5 miles for middle school or high school. Okay. So that is current law.
I understand that, but technically, when it's is that from school? What I read is from the construction area, not the school. In the bill.
I think the assumption is that since if the school district is doing a bonded construction project, it would be on school property.
Okay.
1 mile of
a school. Well, that's fine.
Yeah, 1 mile of an elementary school, 1.5 miles of a secondary school.
Yeah. Is that
right? I know you want to move this along.
No.
And I'm not going to belabor it very much. I'll support the bill, but I will tell you that it's really unnecessary. The reason that it's unnecessary is because, the only thing in here that's really going to change anything is prior to receiving approval from the electors. Planning process, the school district will go to the local government. They will sit down and they will talk about what sorts of projects are going to need to be completed along with the infrastructure sorts of things. The school district is going to put in their budget to pay SDCs to the city. The city's going to put in their budget to reduce certain other costs somewhere else. And it's going to include sidewalks and bike lanes and all of the other sorts of things. So quite frankly, the bill's unnecessary, but if it'll make us feel better to pass it, then I'll go ahead and support it. The other thing is that y'all are talking like this is only during the construction phase. That's not how I read this at all.
No, I
read this as being these are permanent changes that would be looking to be made.
Right.
So when you're looking at construction of sidewalks and bikeways and roadways and all of those sorts of things what you're actually doing. Because generally local governments only look within a certain radius, not within a mile of the project, but with a much smaller radius than that. And basically what you're telling the local government is, we can now charge SDCs for up to a mile and a mile and a half away. So that may end up being an unintended consequence of this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be dependent a lot on how well the local schools and the local governments get along and how well they negotiate with each other and how they play.
Very good. I do think a benefit of this bill as well is that it does require this planning process to take place before going out for the bond, which would allow a school district then to make sure that it was asking for enough money to have the different transportation paths constructed along with the project.
So does that mean we should all shut up so you can pass the bill or keep talking?
Representative Crummel, would I ever say that? Representative Dahl.
I would like to rely on Representative Crummel's expertise, because if this says that the school district is putting pressure on for SDCs, the school district that I once represented Chenoweth, they have no sidewalks. As a result of that, they determined that they would bus every child to school.
Well, currently SDCs aren't allowed to be charged for this, are they?
No.
No.
Be charged to who?
Can SDCs be charged right now for school construction?
You bet it can, and they are.
So there is an impact here.
For the road parts and those things, but not for the
school. But if this bill were to pass, does this give? And I do have a war between my city, which wants street and sidewalk all through the city, the big, my big city, the Dells. I'm sure it wouldn't affect the little ones, but if this gives the district the authority to create those improvement districts, I want to know that.
Well, maybe I should clarify something, Mr. Chair, because I didn't mean to. No, it's not the school district that charges the SDC.
Right.
It's the school district that pays the SDC to the city. If the city were to say to a school like out in Chenoweth, for example, if you're doing a project and the city said, for safety purposes and whatever reason, because we want them, you got to put in sidewalks as part of your construction project, then part of your construction bill is going to be for sidewalks. Usually it might be within a couple hundred feet of the project.
Both ways.
This is now saying within a mile of the project. So as a city, I could turn around and say, you know what, within a 1 mile radius, I want you to put in sidewalks on all those streets that don't have them.
And I certainly so want to know that
the cost of the
before I vote on this bill.
Mr. Chair.
We were saying green.
I think we do need to read the bill again. I mean, basically, the bill only talks about what school districts should consider.
Yeah.
I mean, the only time it gets into this collaboration is on line 14, where it talks about considering joint funding, looking for joint funding for the projects.
Right.
That are going to be built. I mean, other than that, this is about school districts thinking about safe routes to school while they're building a project, and it seems pretty straightforward to me. And my guess is they don't think about that very much now in most of the school districts. That the answer is we're going to bus the kids. I mean, for the city of Portland, I represent three school districts: Portland, Beaverton, and Hillsborough. And Portland, I'm sure it's not an issue. There are sidewalks or whatever is going on. But in Beaverton, particularly in my part of unincorporated Washington County, it's a big problem because there isn't any way, safe way to walk to school in most of the places, besides which the schools are so crowded that the kids go to school somewhere else anyway, not in their neighborhood. But I mean, this is something that it seems to me school districts should be thinking about. We're simply stimulating them to think about it in this case.
And I would agree with Senator Grinicka. Line 14 does say evaluate the potential for joint funding. There's nothing that says it's a mandate for the school district even to share information with the city if it chooses not to. Representative Lim.
Yes. And, well, thank you very much.
We're both bald, so it makes it hard to differentiate us.
Tic-tac-toe-three.
As the representative Grinicka mentioned, we've got to read the bill. Bill says school district shall. That's a commandment.
Mm-hmm.
Shall evaluate the need, and also the subsection B, evaluate the potential joint funding, and also the C mentioned that they consider including the joint improvement together. So my concern is that when we are requiring all of those things, the chances are that they siphon off some of the funds, and then within 1 mile or that the other high schools within 1.5 mile, that's a lot of areas. The unknown factors could be considered into the more money they are going to ask. So that's, I think, one of the issues we need to seriously consider.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Flynn.
Just a process check. Do we have a motion? Are we in public hearing?
We're in a public hearing and work session, so a motion can be made.
I'd like to make a motion.
Representative Clem.
I would move Senate Bill 242 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. I think you have to do 242A. But Representative Clem has made a motion to move Senate Bill 242A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion.
You really don't want any further discussion. You're just saying that to be polite, aren't you?
Representative Rowland, I'm giving up the idea of getting the other two bills done today, so let's take the rest of this one.
All I would say is that as I read this bill, it requires them to consider the plan before they go out for their bond, and that there is no requirement that the cities or anybody finish up. They get to decide the question, they get to decide the others, but at least when they're going to start doing some construction, they consider these alternatives. And I think that's a great thing for everybody to consider, and hopefully it will lead to some of these other things so that we do have safer ways for our kids to get to schools. But from the perspective of this bill, it's going to take more legislation than this to make new SDCs available and everything else. So this bill is just considering it. So.
Thank you, Representative.
Look forward to voting for
clarification. Mr. Chair, I just want to mention I'm not going to vote for this bill at this time, but that during the meantime, I'm going to study the issue more. And then on the floor, I might change the vote at this time, and that I'm going to vote no on this one.
Thank you, Representative.
It's a courtesy no, huh?
Courtesy no. I did one of those last week. Okay. Trying to help you guys out by showing you what the right answer was. No.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I don't see this bill doing anything that local elected officials don't do. It's a feel-good bill. I see no need for the bill.
Thank you.
A yes vote?
I'll say one more.
Representative Roman.
In the testimony from Senator Devlin, and I did not realize that his bills from a future date required or encouraged cities and other groups to work together to solve their problems when doing construction. And I will tell you from the perspective of a water board member, now that I understand where that came from, and why the transportation departments and others were more than happy to work with us in planning, so that they let us know when they were going to do the next road project, so that we could actually arrange our building and putting new water lines and other stuff in. That turned out to be essential, and it wasn't just do feel good. It was a do good something, because it's caused all of us to save money. If this does the same thing, if the cities were planning on going ahead and doing some road construction, and at the same time the schools were doing it, and this bill makes the schools go and say, we're planning on doing this school, we're going to do this kind of stuff. Oh wow, that's really good. We were going to do some road construction. We'll do that at the same time. It has solved hundreds of millions, thousands of dollars could be saved by just having that happen. So from my perspective, this bill does something that can benefit citizens and save public money. So I feel happy voting for it.
Thank you, Senator Roman. Representative Wisdom, any thoughts?
I'll probably give you a courtesy yes, Mr. Speaker. I want to check my school and my school districts.
I'd appreciate that, since I don't have Representative Comp here. I'd appreciate the courtesy yes.
Mr. Chair, I stated earlier that I'll vote for the bill, and I will stay as a yes on the bill, but I really don't think that it is necessary, as we were talking about earlier. The one thing, though, that I would note is that development drives the drives the infrastructure. It doesn't tend to be, in Oregon, it doesn't tend to be the other way around. We are not that far ahead of the curve.
Good point, Representative. Representative Dahl.
I am going to give you a courtesy yes.
Thank you, Representative.
I want to see what Arnie has to say.
Members, ironically enough, this is another bill that Mr. Olson and I looked at and said, well, this will be a simple one to start off.
I went with only the hard ones in my
given that, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Yes.
Representative
Don? Yes.
Representative
Greenlight?
Yes.
Representative
Plum?
Excuse.
Representative
no.
Representative
Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Burnett? Aye. The motion carries. Representative Roblin, would you be kind enough to carry this on the floor for us? I'm going to close the public hearing work session on Senate Bill 242A. I'm going to take a chance, because we have like 3 or 4 minutes left. One witness on the next bill. Supposedly this one is supposed to be an easy one. members. I've opened up a public hearing work session on the Senate bill. Gosh, you know what I'm looking at? How about if I'll do 215A? Does it matter to you?
Yeah.
On Senate Bill 215A. Mr. Olson.
215A allows school districts to admit students up to age 21 years, defines a person in a parental relationship for determining school district residency, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. It passed out of the Senate with, I believe, unanimously.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
For the record, Randy Harnish with the Department of Ed. This bill, as amended, does two things regarding student residency and enrollment. The first, as in the laid out in the written testimony, defines the term person in parental relationship for the purpose of allowing students to enroll in schools where they actually reside. The law in Oregon defines residence as where the student's parents, guardians, or persons in parental relationship reside. This definition was taken from existing law regarding parent-child relationships. It is not our intention to exclude anybody, but to clarify who is eligible for enrolling in school. We believe that this takes a more realistic view of the living arrangements that many students find themselves in and allows districts to enroll kids who are actually living there, who may not be living with a biological parent or a legal guardian, but with someone who's acting like a parent. Grandma, aunt and uncle, friend of the family. Kid really needs to be in school. Districts are, I think, across the state, reading the existing law inconsistently. This definition will tighten that definition up and I think allow districts to enroll kids without obstacle and in all due haste, as we've mentioned earlier. The second change deals with, again, questions that have come up from school districts. The law allow in ORS 339115 sub 1 says that school districts must enroll every student between the ages of 5 and 19. Section 2 of that same section of law says that districts must enroll students who are over 21 or over 19 but not yet 21 if they are in need of additional education to obtain a diploma. So there, again, a lack of clarity and districts are applying that inconsistently. What we are trying to do is to say Section 1 says every kid between the ages of 5 and 19 must be enrolled. If a child is over 19 but not yet 21 and they still need education to obtain a diploma, the district may evaluate that situation, that child's particular circumstances, and may enroll them and continue to claim state school funds for that.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a quick question? Does between 5 and 19 include 5 and 19?
No.
Between 5, as of a student who is 5 as of September 1st and the child's 19th birthday. If the child turns 19 during the middle of the school year, the law allows them to continue.
It isn't between 5 and 19, it's from 5 to 19. Oh.
I think the law, I'd have to go back and
the law states
between the ages of 5 and 19 who reside within the school district. Line 26.
It's 5 years, one day, he's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would assume if it says between 5 and 19, it doesn't include 5 and 19.
Correct. Five does not, if he's just 5 years old, doesn't include. The next day they can get in.
Ah, he's older.
He's older than 5.
And when he gets to be 19, it's not included, just the day before.
Correct. That's correct.
So for that day, he's missed.
We have this.
Never mind. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
This is a really big problem with respect to schools, with regard to when compulsory attendance takes place and who do you go after. It says it does between 6 and 19, so between 5 and 19. So they don't take anybody until they're 6 years old. I mean, these days do make some real meaning, and I think in this bill it's not quite as bad as in others because it's just defining when they can be enrolled in schools, and most districts want to enroll people in school. The problem is, the only thing that I have, I think this does a good clarification. It also opens up a whole lot of other kinds of things that are going to have to now be figured out. So I'm not going to bring them all up right now. So, because OSA will be talking to us and a whole bunch of other people eventually. But
I have some serious reservations about what this bill opens up.
Members, we will then ask Ms. Harsh to come back and spend some time with us. With
your, members of the education. Yeah, there are a lot of things in this bill.
Representative Wisdom.
I just think we would appreciate more information. It's about sports. About the other bill we have, and I have a lot of constituents are upset about the mandatory age of, I think, 7 or 6 that you have to be enrolled, and how those affect this bill.
And I do believe, members, that this bill does. This is not dealing with the mandatory ages. This is the ages that school districts shall admit free of charge students between the ages.
Good.
Yeah, the question is, what if they go live with a coach?
and the other, absolutely. Here's one of his questions. And the other one, I guess, just so you'll be ready, from my perspective, is that. We have kids who are living with people, and the parents
don't want them to be living with that person. And I think the school needs to enroll in them. I think that's all this is doing, even though they're living with people that the parents don't want. And there's battles going on those issues. And I don't want the school to be a third party and all that stuff, which happens from time to time. And this in fact, does clarify that, because it says, all we can do is enroll them. That's our job. We need to do it. And I like that part of this, Bill, but I think it's one of the issues that gets coming up. And, you know, sadly, there's too many people on this committee who have been in these situations. You know, we've had the FBI at our school collecting a person who was kidnapped from other countries. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff with respect to kids and who you have in school. So the bottom line, this bill, as I read it, basically says the school's responsibility is to educate them. And you're going to get school support for it if you take them in. Those are good things. But I think the other issues need to be discussed, because...
Members, if I could request, we're losing people. If the members have any specific questions that I'd like Mr. Harnish to come prepared to answer on this bill, we will schedule this bill for some point next week to talk over with you. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much.
And we look forward to having here the next time we have this bill before us.
Mr. Chair, you and Mr. Olson, next time, pick the bill you thinks the most controversial and hear it and leave the ones you think are no-brainers to the end, and I think we'll be better off.
That advice is well taken, Representative. Thank you for it. Members, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing work session on Senate Bill 215A, and I'm going to adjourn the House Education Committee for today. Thank you, members.